Welcome to The Lead Creative. In this first episode of season 4, we ask a legend of the big and small screen, an actor, a director, a playwright, and an icon of theatre, how does your work live on for generations? Siloma Kekancube has shared his work with the world from a time when there were only a handful of TV channels and remains relevant today when we have near endless media platforms. We'll discuss his thoughts on storytelling, his creative process, and how you can remain relevant in your field.
Just stay authentic. You know, one of the problems is that people keep looking ukuthi kwenzakala and what's happening, you know, and next door. You know what I mean? No. Look inwardly.
This is The Lead Creative. Please share this episode with your network. Spread the love and subscribe. Welcome to the Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Mongezi Mthathi. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Mr. Silo Makekancube, thank you so much for making the time. What an honor to have you on the show with us.
It's only a pleasure, Mongezi. It's only a pleasure. And whatever, hi to your view, to your viewers or to your followers.
Thank you so much. So just to start things off, when you started your career just over 40 years ago, the world was a lot more traditional than it is today. There were limited career paths, and you would have had to blaze a trail and chart a course really for yourself to end up where you are today. How did you stay on that path to become the industry icon that we know you to be today?
Hey, look, man, I think it's, you know, first and foremost, you're actually driven by love, you know, by love of what you're doing. You know, and but it doesn't come easy. There are trials and tribulations along that path, you know. And I think one thing that, you know, I kind of like just stayed on because of love. I mean, I had a one and a half to 2 years break, you know, between, 84 and 85, you know, where I actually, you know, like had to find a little bit of unemployment, and I got a job as an order clerk, but I couldn't stay long. You know, the bug had already bitten me. And so over the weekend one day, I hear about auditions happening at the Market Theater, and went to the Market, you know, and auditioned. And after the audition, you know, they told me that, well, you know, we would like to work with you, but you said you are working, you know. And I said, well, when are you starting rehearsals? And they said, on Monday. And I said, well, on Monday, I will be here. And on Monday, instead of going to work, I went to rehearsals.
And that was it. And that changed, you know what I mean? The course of your life. But I think
the one thing that has made me to stay on, and it has just been love of what I do. And I love acting with all my heart. I mean, going into writing is just because, you know, I think there is a need to tell stories, you know, and in our own way. And that's what got me into the writing and directing, I think, as far back as 1997, you know. And back, yeah, it started 1996. I worked with one director who had a huge influence on me, and he passed on in 1995. And when he passed on, man, I was shattered. I was extremely shattered. Yeah, and, you know, because I had vowed that I was going to like work so close to him and just become his protege. You know, I mean, I had actually said I was just going to, shadow him for the better part of, you know, after we, you know, and the play that, after the play that we were doing. And I was basically even in the last play, the last play that he directed, you know. And after that, it is time to take on the baton and not, you know, wait for anything. And that's what got me into writing and then directing.
Now, and fast forward to today, your work on stage, on screen, and other initiatives that you're part of has touched and inspired many South Africans and many people across the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, after 40 years in the industry, do you ever step back and see how your work connects the people and stories that it touches? Do you almost, because after having been in the industry for as long as you have, are there any moments where you almost like see the puzzle pieces coming together in front of you of how the work connects people?
Look, I mean, you know, I think, you know, I always say to people that I am what I am because, you know, because of you, you know. And especially when, you know, I mean, television is the one that basically like opens you up to the world, you know. And, you know, I mean, with the fames that came, or the notice that came with the, what you call it, Bophelokisimpi, whole generations, you know, because that's where basically it really started. Not even before, because before I did Bophelokisimpi, I did a series called Di Diwela Makholela, you know. I mean, I think that's where the notice basically like started from on television, and then it grew with Bophelokisimpi, and it mushroomed with generations, you know. And I think the humbling thing, and you know, I don't know whether you know what you mean about the pieces, you know, coming together, or the effect that the work that I was doing, and I was just always humbled by just when people recognize you. You know, like sometimes what you would find is that you'd be walking, you know, on the pavement or on the streets, and, you know, another person is walking, you know, coming opposite you, and you can see, you know, I mean, not that you're concentrating on them, but you can see that this person is in their own world and maybe dealing with their own issues, you know. But the moment they recognize me and you just see this person blossom in front of you, you know, and my words is actually when they say, oh, mbone wena namhlanje nyowini lotto. You know. And then later on I said, well, if ever you're going to win it, I'm going to win it too. You know, so ngoba nawe kushuthi uphethe yakho inhlanhla, you know.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. That's true. I know that last year, as well as this year, you've been celebrating a number of milestones in terms of your social media following, growth that's been happening there. And just touching on that, if you are starting out today with the access that we all have to digital platforms, and you were, you know, let's take it back to, you know, back to the 80s and say you are starting all over again, how would you start your career differently today?
I think what I would do is that today I would actually make sure that I go and study the craft of acting, because I never had the opportunity I don't have any formal training as an actor. You know, it is basically something that I kind of loved, and then it exuded out of me. But that's what I would, first and foremost, I would make sure that when I come into the business, I have studied, the craft, the acting craft, you know, and just have a full knowledge of what is happening in the industry. You know, even though, I mean, like one thing that I've discovered is that, you know, I mean, people who come out of the institutions, I don't think they are kind of like equipped enough, you know, in how to deal, you know, with the profession, you know, when they come into the industry, you know. But yeah, I think I would make sure that I go and study. Because, you know, at least when you come out of study, you know, you have worked in, I would say, you know, sort of friendly environment, you know, where you, you know, you made mistakes, and, you know, but, you know, you knew that you are still protected, you know, for me, it was basically like out of the, what is it? Out of the pan into the fire.
You know, into the fire.
While
sure,
I was trying
sure,
to cook.
Sure.
Hey, I was in the fire and I was being bright, you know, by, you know, being observed and being reviewed.
Right, right. Now, as a, you know, as a director, a playwright, somebody who follows talent, who also cultivates some of this talent for your work and in your work as well, does social media in any way play an important role in how the work kind of spreads or how the work reaches people? Because I think just before you answer, I think I just want to go back to the time when you started again. Because I mean, we come from a time when there were a handful of TV channels.
Exactly.
We come from a time when traditional media was the only way to go, into a time today where we have endless platforms to share work. And in some instances, your following is bigger on some platforms than some media channels. Has it helped in any way to fill seats in theaters, to improve how the work spreads?
You know, it is hard to tell. It is hard to tell. But I maybe for now, it is hard to tell. But I know, for instance, because I really became, you know, like a social media active, you know, I think I would say maybe just in the past year, you know, I was present, but, you know, I wasn't really as present as I am now. You know, and I remember the last time I did a play before I did this one, Nothing But the Truth, was in 2017. You know, and the show was a sold out, and I think it was there for me. I would attribute it to the fact that it had to do with, you know, my television, you know, notice, you know, because people know about my work, and I have that large following from television, you know. But you know, I think now with this play, it is actually a combination for me that you know, you find and by the way, today is International Social Media Day, the day we do our recording.
Absolutely, you know? Yes.
So yeah, and today, I mean, I think it's a combination now of maybe my having, you know, having the notice, and then also, you know, social, you know, the presence that is on social media. And I've had people who came to the theater who basically were just following me on social media and had never come and you know, yes, seen a play before. And I think, you know, before I would have those that would come to see me because of Archie fame. You know what I mean? But now I had people generally say, yes, you know, and I saw your this thing, I saw your play on social media, you know, and that is why I came. So social media really plays a very, you know, and that, I mean, in the olden days, it was just word of mouth, basically. Yeah, it was just word of mouth.
Yes.
And, you know, basically social media is actually word of mouth, but sometimes in pictures and, you know, written,
yeah.
You know, it's written social, yes, yes, written word of mouth.
You've already mentioned the role that TV played in how much your work sort of reached people and how people kind of reacted thereafter. I just want to get into a little bit more detail around that. More so the character of Archie Moroka from Generations, because that's where a lot of us, including myself, started to really see your work on a day-to-day basis,
kind of
being brought to us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
How much did that contribute to the mass appeal that you then had after, if you could almost think back to the time, say, before Generations and after Generations, and sort of how the appeal grew in theater outside of TV? Did that make a dent?
I think it did. You know, I think it did, and also, you know, I would, I think it did. But I never had enough time to actually, you know, take that in. you know, because as I, you know, like, I think the whole thing was rising. Then I left Generations and then I left the country. You know, I went to, I went to the UK to do The Lion King, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And, but, you know, the effect of that, I felt it even more when I came back. You know, after 5 years, and I was still like, you know, being called Archie. Excuse me, in 2007, and even now, you know, there's still Archie. You know, and one can just say, you know, and you know, the impact of that was just too massive. You know, you look at, I mean, and also, you know, what was interesting, it was across racial lines. You know,
right.
Yeah, because I mean, I would go into, you know, like, let's say, the so-called colored area. Hey, Archie, hey, Generations, you know,
yeah.
And you go even in an Indian environment, white people, you know, one cannot tell, you know, because it was just the basic, like, well, as we were getting into the new dispensation, you know what I mean? And
yes,
they were kind of very reserved, you know. But in the theater space, you know, I think, you know, white people who were coming to the theater were the ones who were more open to the world, you know, because people who would go to the market theater, you know, people or white people that you'd more classify as liberals, you know, always, yeah, you know, open to, you know, to mix with other races. You know, but the theater community is a very small one compared to the television community.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of your work in the UK and abroad, in your experience telling stories throughout the world, how do you find audiences receive artistic work from Africa? In the sense that, are we telling our stories enough? Are we telling them confidently? And are we telling them well to these audiences?
I think in the theater, in the theater space, we are doing a good job. You know, I'm not too sure about what we do on television. You know what I mean? Because I think, you know, if you look at, you know, most of our television, we are, I think, just representing our human condition in a very, you know, we are criminals and whatever, you know. And whereas, you know, when one has to look at where we come from our history, is that we were always suppressed and looked down upon and, you know, viewed as, you know, people who maybe are of less intelligence, you know. And I think, you know, and when you look at our, you know, television shows, you know, most of them that actually get traction are those that are, or even given, you know, expression are the ones that are dealing with crime, you know. And
right,
we come from a nation of people who were intellectuals. I mean, the Nelson Mandelas were intellectuals. You know, actually, I always say, you know, make a joke and say they were the Model Cs of the time. You know, and even before that, I mean, before the Mandelas, you know, we have like, you know, intellectuals, you know, that lived in the early 1900s and even in the, you know, late 1800s. You know, at the moment, I'm going to be working on a project that talks about the very first black lawyers, or you know, in South Africa. That story comes out of the Thembeka Ncukai Tobi book called
right,
The Land Is Ours, you know.
True. Yes.
And you realize that we had intellectuals, you know, who basically, you know, lawyers who actually used the law to try and fight for the land, you know. And these are the people who are the forefathers, you know, and the creators or people who have actually created the foundation of the constitution that we are having now. You know, so you've got to realize that, you know, we are a people who actually had a good sense, you know, and a good head over their shoulders, that how white people looked at us doesn't define us, you know. Yes. And but also what that book does, you know, it actually shows how the dispossession of land, you know, led us to be where we are now, you know, being a people that almost like don't have a sense of pride. People that don't have a sense of ownership, you know, and the land dispossession basically, you know, made us the perpetual laborers that we actually seem to be at the present moment.
I'm getting two things out of that. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a number of things, but the two I think that are there are that mm-hmm. the one is that the story that we seem to be putting out there, especially on TV and small screens, tends to be one-sided, or at least shows a single facet rather mm-hmm. than the multifaceted people that we are.
Absolutely.
And I think that leads me, and I think that leads me to this question of whether the stories we tell are kind of determined but by what's on demand on these channels or whatever platforms we put them on. Is it governed by that quite a lot? And should that change in any way, in your view?
I think, you know, honestly speaking, and speaking, you know, truth to power, it is because, you know, we are not in control of the media. You know what I mean? All these platforms, in one way or the other, the powers that be, you know, are not concerned about how we should see ourselves as a nation. But we cannot blame the powers that be somehow. I mean, we just come out of 30, I mean, we are almost reaching 30 years of the new dispensation, you know. And I think basically that kind of situation should have been changed by those who we have placed in positions of power and who should have actually taken the time to make sure that we recalibrate our own and the image that we have about ourselves, you know. But, you know, that wasn't done. I mean, I look at situations like, for instance, the Afrikanerbroederbond, you know. Right. The Afrikanerbroederbond was established, what, in 1918? And what was behind the formation of the Afrikanerbroederbond, it was all about the upholding of Africana culture and Africana language. You know what I mean? And yeah. While they were consolidating their culture and their language, you know, and that gave them a sense of self.
Sure.
And in the process of doing that, then they actually worked themselves towards power. And in 1948, you know, the Afrikanerbroederbond was the engine behind the National Party, you know, and that was done in 30 years. And when you look at us in 30 years, we are nowhere near a clear definition or redefinition of ourselves. You know, you actually see it in pockets, you know, but you don't see us as, you know, looking at us as a people that are, you know, walking tall and proud of who we are. I mean, even today, the Afrikaners, bro, you don't mess around with their culture.
Right.
And they preserve it in, you know, jealously on top of that. We don't do that, you know. And my generation, basically, and the one before, you know, which is, you know, your Zuma's and your Mbekis and the Ramaphosas, you know, history is going to judge us harshly. But though I think in a way the former president, Thabo Mbeki, actually for me, you know, it was like some kind of redemption, you know. I was at the celebration of his birthday party. And he made a very strong statement about culture, and spoke about how it has been ignored and how the government had ignored and taken, you know, our culture as just singing and dancing.
Yeah.
You know, and we are more than that. We have a language to preserve. You know, I mean, I've been, you know, talking, I mean, I've knocked on the government doors and spoke to the highest people in authority. You know, I mean, the ministers, you know, in the arts and culture department, and just said, you know, I mean, especially when I came back from the UK and say, hey, here's what I want to do. I want to train actors to be multilingual, you know, because once you have a language, you have a key to a culture. You know what I mean? And if again, if you want to preserve a language, you know, you can only preserve it not by writing books, but let it be spoken and let it be seen in performance. You know,
letting it sort of thrive in front of people and to audiences, absolutely, and to the people it represents.
You know, I'm sure there is a Shakespeare play that you've read. you know what I mean?
Yes.
You know what I mean? And because you know a little bit of English, you know. And I also had the opportunity. I mean, I've done, for instance, I think professionally, I've done 3 Shakespeare plays. I did Julius Caesar. I did
Othello.
Othello, and I did one that is very obscure. I mean, it's not done too often. It's called Titus Andronicus, you know. So I've done 3 Shakespeare plays. And when we were doing Othello, and the Othello, I did it in the UK. When I did Othello, it was the 400th year anniversary of the play, not even Shakespeare, of the play. So the question you ask yourself is, what has made the play to survive for 400 years? It has survived because it was always performed.
Right.
And they're still performing it using whatever the Elizabethan English. And that is what has preserved, you know, that play and the language, because it has been seen in action. We don't see our own languages in action. And not, you know, where we mix them, or, you know, when we are doing, no, indaba ukuthi angu understand. No. Indaba nje ukuthi angu, you know, and speak pure Zulu.
Speaking them purely,
And speak them purely with all the richness and the beauty that is in our languages. We don't do that. And the people who can help in that preservation would be, the performing artists.
Yes.
And for me, the performing artist is like a living custodian or a custodian of our living culture.
Now, just sticking with this idea of storytelling, just with sort of one last question on this particular theme specifically, with cultures and our lifestyles merging so much across the world, how do we differentiate our stories in comparison to anything else that's out there in the world? Because we are seeing that people are becoming, you know, more and more similar the more you look across the world. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, we want to differentiate and tell our stories uniquely. How do we do that?
You know, there's a writer, Ngugiwa Thiong'o. He wrote a book. I mean, he's got many books, but, you know, I'm just going to mention this too. There's a book that he wrote called Decolonizing the Mind. And how he actually even came to, or what led him to coming to writing that book, as he tells the story, is he had come back from, you know, abroad, and he came into his village, and a school teacher in his village came and approached him, and he said to him, I hear you write books. Could you come and help us with our play at school? And that actually made him to think a bit. Here he was, a world-renowned writer, but somebody from his community says, I hear you write books, you know. And that led him to work with the community and, you know, the I can't remember what they called it, the Kimaruti Community Theater, you know, and created plays. And that led him to writing this book called Decolonizing the Mind, which is basically a book, a compilation of essays of the process, you know, that he was, you know, engaged in when he was working with the community. And then, you know, he wrote a sequel to Decolonizing the Mind, calling it Moving the Center. And basically like moving the Eurocentric to, you know, the Afrocentric center, you know, to right. The Afrocentric, yes. And he mentions something very interesting in that book. And he says, universality comes out of locality. What makes us common is that we are the human race.
Yes.
But we are the human race that is living in different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Influenced by different cultures. You know, we all have the elements that makes us, or that are the components of our human condition, be it jealousy, love, greed, you know, all those characteristics. We all have them, but they manifest themselves in different ways.
Yes.
You know, a thief in the township and a thief in corporate world. They are thieves, but they're working around.
They manifest differently.
You know, and that's what makes the world interesting. You know, to actually even somehow draw those commonalities or the commonalities, you know, the similar that we have, how similar we are, but how it seems like, like we are different. You know,
yes.
I used to remember, I mean, when we were growing up, I mean, in the, you know, you always hear that, they would say young girls are always going around with these bumakinza and all those kind of things, you know,
yes.
Because bumakinza, they are driving nice cars, you know, jewelry, and they've got money.
Mm.
But today, I mean, and now today you actually find now the tendapronees.
Yes,
you know,
yes, have taken the lead in comparison, you know, to, yeah.
That, and it even goes worse, you know. And the thing that, you know, and for me, it's like you can actually just look at how the human condition works, you know, because, and somehow, you know, it brings a very interesting analysis into the gender dynamics.
Yes.
You know what I mean? If a girl in the township goes for umakinza, you know what I mean? And then, but also there's the tendapronier, but also there is the millionaires, you know what I mean? And there will be those who would actually want to see themselves around people who've got lots of money,
yes.
You know? So for me, it is just a way of, you know, the world is just so open, but it has its different stratas. And the stories will always have differences because of the, you know, the milieu that they are in, the scenarios
that
they find themselves
in. And in a way, it documents our life. It kind of gives us a lens through which we live at a particular point in time. Yeah,
absolutely.
This episode is sponsored by the digitally led customer experience agency, Roger Wilco. For all your customer experience, digital marketing, and web development needs, go to rogerwilco.co.za or rogerwilco.co.uk. You can also download the South African CX Report and the Township CX Report directly from their website, free of charge. Don't we all love something free every now and again, especially with insights, right? Now back to the show. As a legend in your field who has been at it for over 4 decades. Can you describe your creative process? I imagine it differs from one to the next. And I think when, you know, someone like me who works in the creative industry looks at someone who is so amazing at what you do, I often wonder what the creative process is behind that and how you follow that creative process. Because one of the guests we spoke to on the show says, don't steal your creative work, but steal the process that gets people to how great they are in what they do. Can you describe your creative process to us?
Look, I don't know. To be creative for me, it's actually I have never really sat down and really made an analysis of it, you know.
Yes.
But creativity comes in so many ways. If I am directing, you know what I mean? I will make a plan. Okay, I would like to look at this and I would want to try. But once you actually start doing, once I'm in the rehearsal room and there are things that now just comes because they are growing out of something, you know. So for me, creativity is, it is work in progress all the time.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it is only the revisioning, you know, when you revise what you have done, that now you start, you know, trying to put shape onto it. And maybe also what I will say is that somehow what I would do is I would always say, you know, I work like a sculptor. You know, a sculptor takes a block of wood or a block of stone, you know what I mean? And a sculptor, when he works by elimination. You know, if he's going to carve, you know, and then he will be chipping away in order to get the form that he wants, you know, the form that he sees in his head.
Yes.
Out of that stone or out.
Yes.
Of that block of wood. You know what I mean? So for me, it's like at times I work chaotically and then I start eliminating to get the form that I want.
That's very insightful, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it's like the chaos in some instances is part of the process.
It's
part
chaos
of getting you to.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you draw your inspiration? How do you draw inspiration? What would you say brings you there or takes you to that point?
Life, you know, because I'm fascinated by the human condition. I really am fascinated by the human condition. And, you know, my first acting lesson that I got was from my Baba Mnani. Mm. You know, he was also an actor. Worked with Gibson Kente in a play called Sicalo. You know, and the first acting lesson that he gave me at the age of 15, he broke down the word actor, you know, and he said A stands for action, C stands for creativity, T stands for technique, O stands for observation, R stands for reaction. All these five things you use as an actor, you know, and
yes.
The most important, you know, and I think for even a writer, you know, the most important thing that an actor has got to learn is observation. You've got to observe life around you, you know. And that is how basically that first lesson, I have actually taken it forward and, you know, analyzed it even much deeper, you know. Because I looked at, you know, that what I appreciate is human behavior. And that is where I draw inspiration from. So the most important thing is that you have got to observe and observe.
Yes.
Life around me. And then now that observation has got to be, you know, happen in two ways. There is the external and then there is the internal observation that you have to make, you know. And the internal, you know, it's, you know, observing yourself well, for instance, if you are in a state of nervousness. You know, for an ordinary person, when they get nervous, they will just be nervous. But for an actor, if you actually experience that sensation of nervousness, you actually almost like, oh, so this is how I am when I'm nervous. And basically, you put record that, you know, and you record that sensation
right
in your brain. so that if you are going to be required to play nervousness, you know, you go to the, you know, the folder of nervousness, you click it and say, and then, you
step
play
into
the nervousness.
That space, yeah.
Yeah, so whatever is, in fact, for an actor and even any creative person, what is normal to people and, you know, and people take for granted, to them, they look into it and interrogate it much deeper.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and how, and then, for instance, when you do this internal observation, it is almost like now you are training yourself and fine-tuning yourself because your body is your instrument. You know, when a pianist learns how to play, you know, the piano, you know, an actor has got to learn how to play their body.
Right.
And how to execute all those emotions on demand. Because as a musician would play a chord on demand, same the actor, but that is a rigorous process that I foresee that an actor has got to undergo. And not go into, you know, like these days, you know, you find people say, you know, when I get into character, man, you know, when I get into character, I think that is the biggest BS ever. There's no getting into character, you know. A character is defined by actions.
Yes.
I'm the interviewee, you are the interviewer. And anybody just has to, you know, observe, you know, and they will see that I am being the interviewer and the interviewee. You know, I'm basically just answering questions. And yes. You are the interviewer. You are sitting, so I've got to drive. I've got to drive this conversation. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I'm just saying, well, I just hope I'm going to answer, you know, give whatever answers. And that's it, you know. And so where is getting into character? Because if somebody would, in fact, let's say, somebody transcribes this conversation.
Yes.
You asking questions, me answering. Are you trying to get into character? No, you are just doing the actions that an interviewer does.
Yeah.
I'm just doing the actions that
except I had to get into character because I'm talking to a legend, so I had to.
You absolutely are.
I think life is your biggest inspiration and observation the biggest tool to that inspiration, and as a result, understanding yourself and knowing yourself at any point and being able to tap into that that knowledge of self that you keep learning from. So as the world changes, because the world has changed a lot since, you know, since you got into the industry, you know, from TV to digital and now the growth of streaming, how do you keep yourself relevant? How do you keep yourself relevant in a world where there's so much happening in our lives? There are so many, you know, so many actors, creative people, legends, icons coming and going, and yet you remain relevant. I mean, I was watching a movie on Netflix just the other day that you are in. I'm looking forward to your play in October. So you are certainly relevant in the, you know, in the fabric of society. How do you do that? How do you remain relevant for over four decades? So for someone starting today and building their career, how do they maintain that? How do they grow and build that?
Be original. Here's something that, you know, also, you know, I hear young people talking about it, you know, and you hear a person say, you know, when, you know, I'm still working on my brand, you know, I'm still working on my brand. I'm of the view that your brand is formed long before you even know that you are a brand. Your brand, one's brand is formed the day one's father's sperm meets with their mother's egg. That's when that brand is formed. And that is so definitive through even the DNA. But what makes it even more powerful, you know, because one thing that is constant when you look at life is just the same. It is us who are trying to make it seem like it, you know, it is changing. You know what I mean? But life is just the same. The way a human being or even an animal was conceived 10, 40,000 years ago is still the very same way. You know, men, because, you know, they observe and they, you know, science, which is what I look at also as acting, that acting is a science that can be learned. You know what I mean? So, but what manifests that even more is that at a bank, when you go, they would, yeah, you know, you would sign, they will, you know, expect you to sign. But one thing that they would think they trust more than your signature is your fingerprint.
Yeah.
And I get Kofana now. There is none like you. That is your brand. What is the meaning of brand? There is no other Coca-Cola. It's just Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
So when you are Mongis, there is no another Mongis. We may have the same name and even maybe the same surname. But here's something that is going to define us is your fingerprint. And right. Now what I say is, if you want to say you are working on your brand, what you are saying is you are almost wanting to manifest the fine print that is on your fingerprint. And that takes one into looking into inwardly into who they are. And who they are will always manifest as long as you stay true to yourself. People try and your truth will remain your truth. And if you work within your space, I don't try to do things and say, I want to be relevant and try and do it. No, I just do what I do because I love it. Yes. And out of it, then, you know, where that gift is coming from will manifest itself in staying true and focused to the moment.
That's a really insightful point for us to end off. And I think out of that, I get this sense that authenticity and remaining authentic to yourself, to your art, to your craft, the love that you give and how much you almost sort of understand yourself and keep learning is what keeps you relevant. Would that distill it the way that you told us today?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, just stay authentic. You know, one of the problems is that people keep looking ukuthi kwenzakala and what's happening, you know, and next door. You know what
yes.
I mean? No.
Yes.
Look inwardly. Because even the way you experience things in your own way. God didn't make you different because he doesn't know what he's doing. You have just got to find an experience or, you know, look deep into what is it that makes me different? How do I look at the world? And manifest that and exercise that. And as you keep doing something, you get better at it. I would say that is how I reinvent myself.
Thank you so much. This was an amazing conversation, and it was an honor to have you with us.
Thank you, Mongis. I enjoyed myself too. Thank you, man. And to your viewers, all the best. Stay true to yourself and stay out of harm's way.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. Pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.